Hi everyone, welcome and thank you for joining us today for another episode of Lid Radio Podcast. I'm your host for today, Asaro, and for this episode, we have a very special guest with us. She's author of The Human Moment. It is Amy Bradley. Amy, welcome. How are you today?
Hi, Asaro. I'm well, thank you.
So I'm going to give our listeners a brief introduction into who you are and the topic of this book before we get into the questions and the very interesting topics we're going to cover. So Amy Bradley is a researcher, writer, TEDx speaker, facilitator, corporate trainer, and academic. In her work, she helps individuals, teams, and organizations to improve their performance by fostering kinder, happier, healthier, and more engaged workplace environments. In her book, The Human Moment, she argues that compassion is a core value which is too often overlooked in business. Based on a decade of research and packed with examples and case studies, this book argues that compassion is the hidden key to unlocking business performance potential in the 21st century. So, let's begin with our first question. Compassion, a key word which I just mentioned in this brief overview. Compassion is one of the main areas covered in your book. What is the definition of compassion, and can people develop their compassion, or is it something that everyone is born with?
An interesting question to open up with, Asaro. When I ask people what compassion means to them, words like care, empathy, understanding, or even love tend to come up. But what might be helpful when we're establishing what we're talking about is to distinguish between self-compassion and compassion for others, because both, I would argue, are important. Both, you know, for our lives at home and at work. So if we're thinking about self-compassion, I suppose the best analogy I could give you would be that of an oxygen mask. So, you know, when we're all on a plane and they say, put your own oxygen mask on before helping others, that's how I would describe self-compassion. So we're no good to anyone else unless we first start with ourselves. And what I've noticed in my work with individuals in organisations for the last 10 years is people have what I call self-anaesthetised to cope with work. So they've kind of turned their emotional thermometers down or off. So many people have forgotten how to feel. They're so focused on performing and on task that they've kind of forgotten about themselves. So for me, compassion has to start with yourself. Environments at work do tend to be stressful, and we've kind of normalized that stress, I would say, at work. But there are steps we can take to put that oxygen mask on and to become more compassionate for ourselves. And in the book, I refer to Kristen Neff's work in this area. So she talks about self-compassion having three components. So first of all, it's about developing a kinder attitude towards ourselves, something she calls self-kindness. So when things don't go to plan, when we feel inadequate, or we fail, or we do something that we think is wrong, we, instead of beating ourselves up with self-criticism, you know, that inner voice we have that says, oh my goodness, I didn't do very well then, or I didn't say the right thing or do the right thing. Instead of being critical, we develop a kinder attitude to ourselves where we just notice that we have that inner critic, that voice. And rather than judging it, we just notice and let it go. So that's the first aspect of self-compassion. The second is mindfulness. So that's noticing how we are, but taking a non-judgmental state about how we are. So if we're feeling tired, or we're feeling irritable, or if we're feeling low, or if we're feeling energized or excited, whatever that might be, we just notice that we're in that state and just develop that capacity for noticing and non-judgment in the moment. And then the third aspect of self-compassion, when we're going through a difficult time, when we're under pressure at work, we can often feel that it's only us that's suffering in this way, or if we're going through something difficult in our personal lives, a bereavement, critical illness, family breakdown, relationship problems, we can sometimes feel this irrational sense of isolation. Why me? You know, why is this happening? But actually, to be human is to suffer. That's something that we all share as human beings. So the third aspect of self-compassion is to recognize that we're all the same. We're all cut from the same cloth. We all suffer, fail, feel inadequate at times, and we're not alone. So developing this sense of common humanity is really important in self-compassion. So that's the first way I define compassion. It's from the point of view of the self. Mm-hmm. The other way of looking at compassion is compassion for others. And when we're thinking about compassion for others, I would say it's more than empathy. Empathy is perspective taking, or trying to put oneself in somebody else's shoes. Compassion is one step further than that, and that's about taking action. So compassion for others for me is threefold. And this builds on the work of Jane Dutton and others at the University of Michigan, where they talk about compassion being the capacity to notice that someone's going through something difficult. So how developed are our antennae at work, noticing that something is happening for someone, that they're struggling in some way, feeling empathy, so putting yourself in their shoes and trying to take their perspective, but then going one step further and responding or helping in some way to try and alleviate suffering.
In the book, you provide us with shocking, eye-opening facts about mental health issues, such as the fact that 12 million adults in the UK seek support from their doctor for mental health issues every year. And you also mention matters such as workplace loneliness, which have had an impact on important issues such as this. At the same time, you've shown that only 24% of managers have received any mental health training in the past year. How is this possible? And also, how can we change this going forward?
Yeah, it's interesting because in the book, I tell a story of an experience I had on a train traveling back from work sometime last year when I was starting to write the book. And what happened was I got on a busy train at the end of a workday to travel out of London, and the train was packed. All the seats were taken. There was literally nowhere to stand, full of commuters. And just before departure, a woman got on the train with her baby and two young children. And the woman appeared quite stressed, and the children seemed fractious and tired, and she was confined to standing just by the doors with her buggy and two toddlers. And I looked round the carriage and noticed that not one person acknowledged this woman's struggles. People were just too busy looking at their own phones or sort of preoccupied with themselves and, you know, their own issues. But I just thought, you know, what happens to people at work so that they get on the train at the end of the workday and they're incapable of noticing someone else's struggles? Not one person offered this woman a seat or seats for the children. So I stood up and offered them my seat. And I just started to question, you know, that people are mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, friends. So we all know what it's like to travel with young children, but what happens to people when they go to work that changes them and, you know, makes them so focused on task that they forget about people around them? I think our workplaces have become increasingly transactional and increasingly dehumanized. So we're so preoccupied with success that we fail to look after ourselves, let alone our colleagues down the corridor. And organizations reward the output of task. We have this kind of self-focused individualism in our society, rather than what I would call an other-focused collectivism, which lies at the heart of compassionate cultures, which means, you know, we're each for themselves, basically. If you look at global employee engagement levels, they are anemic. I think it's something like 1 in 7 of us get up in the morning and look forward to going to work. Yet we know that if people feel cared for and valued at work, and if they have good relationships with people around them at work, they're more likely to be engaged. But as I said before, people have developed this self-anesthesia to survive. People seek out connection. You know, more and more people work remotely now. More and more people are self-employed. We have virtual teamwork. So people are craving connection. We see loneliness levels in society increasing. People are craving connection, but when they get to work, people seem to be too busy to actually attend to one another. And in the book, I argue that to change that, we can each make time for what I call a human moment every day. So just taking the time to connect and care for someone at a basic human level. Mm-hmm. Just taking the time to ask somebody how they are and being open to their response and being genuinely interested in how people are feeling. I try to do that if I can every day. You know, it might just be a conversation when I'm walking the dog in the morning, or, you know, when I'm walking into work, just to connect with someone and have a conversation about how they are.
I just want to go back quickly because you mentioned some very important statistics about global employment being very, very anemic. And you mentioned very, very shocking results. And it's very, very important to our listeners to understand that they themselves may be going through a current period of employment where, like you said, they're not happy, but we don't know why. And everything you mentioned is very interesting because it puts into perspective the importance of this issue and how serious this issue has become. And it actually leads me on to my next question, because we hear so many stories from friends and relatives, and we even have stories ourselves which we're able to share with others, which express this dissatisfaction with the workplace. And we don't often feel comfortable in these working environments because there may be a lack of communication, or likewise, due to occupational hierarchy, there may be a lack of sympathy between ourselves and what we're receiving from our bosses and our superiors. But this is a very broad question, but the truth of the matter is, what can we do to change this? How can we have these conversations with our colleagues? How can we make that human moment impactful? And how can we, you know, as you've said, reclaim the compassion in the workplace?
Well, it goes back to each and every one of us making gestures to make this happen. Like I said earlier, one thing that connects us all as humans is that we all suffer. And if I can just share, it was a personal experience of my own that led me into this field. So 13 years ago, when I was pregnant with my daughter, my fiance at the time was killed suddenly when I was 6 months pregnant. And I was thrown into a period of intense grief and coming to terms with motherhood for the first time simultaneously. And it was gestures of compassion from my workplace at the time that made me realise the importance of compassion at work. And those gestures have stayed with me and have made me determined to try and effect change in our workplaces about what's acceptable to share or not share when it comes to what's going on in our personal lives. If each of us can find the courage to make a personal disclosure about, you know, daily struggles or a more significant life experience, this creates space for a human moment. And often people say, well, that's out of bounds at work. But I would argue that actually the whole person goes to work. So whatever's going on for us in our personal lives affects our motivation, our energy levels, the way we relate to people. So it absolutely affects who we are at work. We can't kind of switch our personal lives off when we walk through the door. And by having the courage to make these disclosures, this can often open up a space for someone else to disclose their own. It kind of creates a platform, I suppose, for real feelings to be shared at work. It does take courage, and often it can take challenging the norms of what happens in your workplace. But my research has found if somebody takes a step to do that, it can profoundly change your relationship with that person from then on. And some of the leaders I've worked with, it's been a watershed moment in their lives, you know, a cancer diagnosis, a bereavement, something that has been transformational for them that's made them change the way that they are at work, and they're much more open as a result.
Could we just say,
something important to kind of take note of is my research and my work has found that these disclosures are more likely to take place outside of the work environment. If you work somewhere that people tend to keep a lid on their emotions. So my research has found that when people are, for example, out for lunch, coffee, traveling with a colleague, and they're outside of work, they're more likely to feel safe to share and less kind of under the spotlight if they're outside of the workplace. And I suppose the other thing I would say is it's important for us to develop the capacity to kind of be open to these disclosures. And in the moment, that person may just want you to listen and to ask questions rather than trying to resolve their situation. It's just opening up a safe space where they feel that they can talk without judgment. Does that answer the question?
Absolutely. And you mentioned a very relevant point about changing the dynamics between leaders, managers, and their colleagues. And I just wanted to build upon that. I wanted to know, for many of our listeners listening, they will be themselves managers and leaders of groups and teams in their businesses. How do they know they're on the right track, especially to achieving that human moment? How do they know? What can they see in their workplace which tells them that they are showing off compassion and sympathy and they are being more interactive and they are having healthier dynamics with their colleagues?
Yeah, I don't think we can underestimate the importance of what I call competent compassion among line managers. So behind our workload and challenges in our personal lives, management style is the third most common cause of stress at work. So it must, from my point of view, I would advocate for this development to start happening at line management level, because it's line managers who have the closest contact with their teams day to day. And there's steps that line managers can take to develop this competent compassion that I talk about. One is just being available for your team. You know, actually making time to be available for your team. It can be very difficult if we feel our line manager is too busy to see us, because that kind of sends a message about what's important. So being available is the first thing I would say, is, you know, carving out time to be there for your team. I suppose the second thing I would say is developing the capacity to listen, and to really listen. You know, not jump into solutions, but just to be there and be attentive for what your colleagues are saying to you, and trying to put yourself in their shoes, or to take their perspective, which might be very different from your own. This takes line managers to get to know their teams at a level that I would say is much more intimate than most people would expect. We really need to know those people around us to be attuned to signs that things might be difficult for them. And I would say setting an example. So if you have a line manager that is role modeling these behaviours, who is open themselves about, you know, that they're having a bad day, that they also, you know, fail and feel inadequate and suffer and are basically human, that goes a long way for helping others to feel safe about doing the same. Another suggestion I make in the book is that there could be one simple question that managers could keep in mind on a daily basis, which is, how can I help this person to have a better day? What can I do to help this person to have a better day? And if we all take these steps, you know, we start to hopefully affect positive change.
You share in the book many great examples of companies, and you call them consciously compassionate companies. Could you share an example with one of us and our listeners who are listening and are excited about buying this project of yours?
So what I found interesting in this whole process of writing the book is that consciously compassionate companies, as I call them, are actually few and far between. I put a call out on LinkedIn for companies that are actively seeking to embed compassion, and so that compassion is systemic within the organisation. And I had a few volunteers. I mention a number of companies in the book. I mention LinkedIn itself. I also mention Cisco Systems and other organisations, Philips, the healthcare technology company. And I feature three organisations in depth as case studies. The first is Yodel. They're a parcel delivery business. The second, Yodel employ about 10,000 people in the UK. The second is a visual effects company called Outpost. They employ about 150 people. And the third is a very small micro business, interior design partnership, 10 employees, all of whom are women. So they're the three examples that I go into depth on in the book. I wanted just to talk about two examples here, one large, one small. But before I do so, I just wanted to make the business case for conscious compassion, those organisations that seek to embed compassion in their cultures do report higher engagement amongst staff, higher levels of profitability, stronger customer advocacy, and greater levels of teamwork. So it's not just nice to be nice. There is actually a business case for organisations to be consciously compassionate. So the two examples I want to draw on, LinkedIn, the first one, that's the large organisation. Its founder, Jeff Weiner, has oriented the entire company around compassionate leadership. LinkedIn had 300 employees 10 years ago. There's now 12,000 across the business. Just a few examples of how they've embedded compassionate leadership across the organisation. They have fortnightly all-company meetings that Weiner himself hosts, where he's very transparent with what's going on in the business. They have what they call in-days among teams across the organisation, where teams are asked to clear their diaries of task and just spend time with their teams. That's what I would say is there are many human moments. They have a course called Managing Compassionately. And in this course, Weiner himself talks about his own experience of learning to manage with compassion, the importance of line managers getting to know team members and seeking to put themselves in their shoes. And they actually run a compassion award that you might see publicized across social media. That compassion award is calling for individuals in organizations all over the world to create a 90-second video that talks about what they're trying to do to become more compassionate. And LinkedIn then choose a winner and support that winner to grow that initiative. So that's LinkedIn. The other example is Outpost, the visual effects company I mentioned earlier. That company are based in Bournemouth in the UK, founded by someone called Duncan McWilliam. And Duncan founded the company based on what he calls fair trade visual effects. Just to give you some background to the company, they've worked on visual effects for films like Jurassic World, the Jason Bourne series, and TV series like Black Mirror and Watchmen. He set up Outpost as a kind of, I suppose, reaction to the way he was treated in big companies he'd worked for before that had treated him as a number and that were dehumanized. And he didn't want to see that in his own organization. So he's set up Outpost that now has 150 people. And he talks about profit being secondary to the well-being of staff. The well-being of staff is his priority and profit comes second. And the culture is built around compassion. So if you go to Outpost, you'd see a very different kind of workplace. So there's music playing, people bring their dogs to work. They have lifetime, it's unlimited leave for staff. So staff are trusted to take the amount of leave that they need. And it's not approved by line managers. It's actually self-organized within teams. So you agree with your teammates when and how much you're going to take off, and teammates support you with that. So it's not like it's escalated up and signed off. You just agree it. And they found that giving employees this trust and unlimited leave, it's not abused. People actually, when they're trusted, work well to support each other. And they work really hard to make sure these values are upheld, I should say, within the organisation. So, you know, behaviours that aren't compassionate are called out. So if people are seen behaving in a way that isn't seen to be kind, you know, that doesn't mean not having difficult conversations, but, you know, those behaviours are called out if, you know, someone's seen as being uncompassionate in some way. And so there's kindness embedded across the business. So there are a couple of examples, but many more in the book.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Amy. Before we go, for anyone interested in knowing more about your projects, more about the book and everything you've written, where can they find out more about you and follow your work and your studies?
So I have a LinkedIn profile. So if you search Dr. Amy Bradley, you'll find me on LinkedIn. In my day job, I'm a member of faculty at Ashridge Holt. So you can also search me under Holt International Business School or Ashridge Executive Education. They'll both come to the same place. You can also find me there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today, Amy. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Wishing you lots of human moments from now on.
Thank you. Yes. And I'm going to pass that on to my business and also to our listeners listening. It's a very important discussion, a very crucial conversation, and it is very vital to the success and the well-being of our lives. So I just want to thank everyone for listening. Don't forget to keep an eye out on our social media. That's at Lib Publishing on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And of course, for more information about our new books, expert opinions, and of course, more podcasts with amazing thought leaders such as Amy Bradley herself, Dr. Amy Bradley herself. We'll see you next time on Lib Radio Podcast. I've been your host, Asaro. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.